Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast for church leaders from FIEC churches and other churches too. You're very welcome. It's good to have you with us. My name is Adrian Reynolds, the Associate National Director for the FIEC, and I'm joined today by Andy Hunter, who's our Director for Scotland. Hello, Andy.
Morning, Adrian. Good to see you.
All the way from Glasgow. Yes. How is Glasgow today? So we have to just discuss the weather because we're very British. It's a bit of a grey overcast day here in Leicestershire. What about Scotland?
Yeah, that would be similar. We've had a pretty good summer overall, but we're kind of back to kind of traditional kind of grey skies and a little bit cooler. So we're kind of used to
it. You and I are doing the news because we're from Scotland and Leicestershire, the only place where schools are back this week. So we're available to talk about the news. So everybody else is away on holiday, getting a well-earned break. You and I have had our holidays, so we're back into it, aren't we, Andy? And we're here to talk about the news. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And we're going to start by talking about peace. There are obviously a number of conflicts going on around the world, and very much in the news in the last couple of weeks has been the meeting between Trump and Putin. Did you see any of that footage, Andy, that was on television of the two of them greeting one another and sort of smiling and almost joking? It felt slightly uncomfortable, didn't it? It did to me anyway.
Yeah, it was kind of odd, kind of remarkable. I mean, one sense it's good because you want people to talk, and people are being killed and damage is being done. So anything that might bring peace a bit closer, then you've got to be kind of glad of. But yes, it's a kind of strange thing. People that are so far apart in so many ways talking about something so serious. But I guess that's the nature of it. What did you think yourself?
Well, I mean, I think I find it very difficult to know what to think about some of these situations. But I think the way they were grinning at one another at one point almost just gave me a little bit of, I just felt a little bit uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Zelensky was shut out of that meeting. He did later meet, didn't he, Trump, with the other European leaders in Washington. But it did feel a little bit as though, you know, Zelensky in Ukraine with a small guy being caught up in the geopolitics of the big nations. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if it leads to peace, it feels like it's got to be a good thing. I'm fairly pessimistic about it all. I don't know about you, Andy. It seems to me, I mean, we want just peace, don't we? We don't just want peace at any price. Peace is good, but we do want there to be justice as well. We have a deep kind of sense of that, don't we, as Christians? And it seems to me that a just peace looks pretty elusive still. I can't see. Can you how Ukraine really can come out of this without giving up land? And that doesn't feel very just.
Yeah, no, I think it feels one of those situations historically where there'll have to be some kind of settlement at some point. At the moment, it feels very much like stalemate at all kind of levels.
Yeah.
It's a kind of grinding, kind of ongoing situation on the ground. And so you do feel there'll be a settlement, but it will be unjust, almost inevitably. Yeah. And I guess that kind of raises questions about, without trying to conflate geopolitics with kind of local church life too much, obviously
is there a danger in that, do you think, then? Is there a danger in conflating, you know, what we see in the world with church life? There are similarities, aren't there?
There are similarities, and there are some crossover principles, I think, but you've got to be wary as well of not just conflating the two things or thinking that it can be dealt with exactly the same way. I guess it's a bit like, you know, criminal justice as opposed to kind of personal kind of relationships, that you might turn the other cheek in a kind of personal situation where you feel a bit offended or grieved. But that's not to say that you wouldn't report a crime. So, you know, we hold these things together. We need a bit of wisdom in doing that. Mm. But in terms of the kind of idea of being in a situation where the outcome's going to feel quite unsatisfactory, it's going to feel probably a bit unjust that somebody who has been the sinner in that sense is probably going to come out of this with more than they ought to. How do we get that balance in kind of church life? Because sometimes we're in a culture where people seem to want to kind of pursue a kind of good outcome at all costs. But then there's a balance there between saying that sometimes in a fallen world, we're going to have to accept that this side of heaven, we're not going to get a completely just outcome. So I don't know if you get any wisdom on that.
Well, I guess part of that so much depends on context, doesn't it? I mean, I guess it depends whether you're talking about two individuals in the same church. Mm-hmm. If you've got two individuals in the same church and you as a leader are trying to reconcile people, situations happened, they're both part of the church. They've signed up to the church's authority, haven't they? They're both members of the church, maybe, and they've put themselves under the discipline of the church. That's a different situation, isn't it? Where you've got one person in a church who's dealing with a situation, has been wronged, perhaps, and the person who's wronged them is not in your church. You don't have any connection with them. I guess that would be a different situation where there comes a moment where you may have to say to someone, you're going to have to leave that with the Lord. That's a really painful place to be. But I think if you've got two people in the church, I do want to be an optimist. I do want to think, you know, we need to be pursuing peace for the sake of the church, actually, as well as the sake of the individuals. Yeah. I think once you start having people who are perhaps not Christians or are spread around, it's much more difficult to know what influence we can have as leaders. It seems to me that the people in front of us are the people who need our love and care and support and help. We've got no authority, have we, over an other who's 100 miles away.
I think that's the thing. And coming away from the kind of Ukraine and Trump and Putin for a moment, because obviously the operating system of the world is different from the operating system of the church.
Operating system is very different. I think that's definitely true, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, politics is all about kind of power, isn't it? And kind of gain and influence and kind of
image.
Those kind of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and that ought not to be the case in the church. Sadly, sometimes
we feel
like that within the church. But there is that kind of balance, isn't there, between situations where you have to say, this side of heaven, I just have to entrust myself to the one that judges justly. Actually, I do believe that there will be a day of justice. There'll be a day of judgment, that the things done in secret will be made open. And actually, there will be vindication and there will be restoration for sin and offences. But I'm not always going to get that in this life. That's difficult sometimes to know the balance between when you lay that down and when you keep going, because we don't want to be in a kind of society or even a church where there's a free-for-all for injustice or for evildoers just to get away with things because we kind of say, well, we're going to leave it with the Lord.
That's at some level, that's a very profound response, leave it with the Lord. And at other levels, it's a very trite response. It depends on the context, doesn't it? If someone's been badly treated, you say, oh, well, just leave it with the Lord. I mean, that's a very trite response to something that's very serious. And the Bible would say, no, there's something more to be done at that point. But there comes a point in that pursuit of peace where actually that becomes a very profound response. This is the very same words. That's very interesting, isn't it? I think you're right about the ultimate justice. I mean, even, you know, Putin one day is going to face a day of judgment. Yeah. And I think it seems to me the fact that Christians don't talk very much about the future and about the day of judgment has impoverished us when it comes to dealing with the world in the present tense. Do you think that, you know, we do have a deep sense of justice, but we also have a deep sense of trusting the Lord's justice at some point, that actually all sin will be paid for?
Yeah. And in a society and a culture where a belief in God or a belief in final justice, that there will be an end, there will be a day of reckoning for these things, when that recedes, then of course people have got to get everything sorted out now. And the tragedy is that sometimes you see people who have expended their whole lives trying to kind of, as it were, right a wrong in a way that they're just not able to do, at great cost to themselves, sometimes at great cost to their family and to others around them. Yeah. Their life has kind of been poured out on a particular kind of issue or grievance. And sometimes it's a great sorrow with that they're not able to leave it with the Lord, to trust him with that. And in one sense, I've been reading in 1 John recently about the faith that overcomes the world. And ultimately, it's that faith that ultimately God will put things right. There will be a day of vindication that allows us to overcome some of these things in the meantime. And people might look at Putin and think he's making fools of the West. But ultimately, of course, the Bible says if he's doing that, he's the fool, because he's going to stand before God at some point. And, you know, he won't look quite so smart then.
There's lots of Bible help here, isn't there? Because what we're not advocating is saying, you know, someone comes to us in church and has been badly treated. We just say, oh, well, never mind. That's exactly what we're not saying. Mm. There's a lamenting over sin. There's a sorrow over sin. And there's a right pursuit of justice, isn't there? So, I mean, you get that in Romans 12. Mm. I think Romans 12 is a very important chapter in Romans, you know, explaining how this life of Jew and Gentile together, both sinners, but both redeemed by grace. How's this life going to work out? And it seems to me it's a very honest chapter about just some of the challenges there will be, some of the difficulties there'll be, especially towards the end of that chapter. So as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Yeah. I think that gives us a command. Mm-hmm. You know, we're to live at peace with everyone. We are to pursue that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But actually, there's a recognition in there as well that in this life, sometimes it's just not possible. Yeah. Relationships do mm-hmm. break down. You think of a marriage. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, very sadly, marriages do break down. Mm-hmm. And that's the impact of the broken world we live in, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because there's the sense in which there are things which are clearly illegal or criminal, and they ought to be reported.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because
absolutely,
if we're so
absolutely
pious, right, and we think we're not going to report a crime, then the danger is we just create a lawless society. And the people who suffer in a lawless society are the most vulnerable and the weak. So we're not helping anybody by turning a blind eye to criminality. But then there are those kind of lower level, kind of interpersonal kind of gripes and conflicts and slights and grievances, which I think particularly those verses about turning the other cheek and love covering a multitude of sins applies to. But in terms of disagreements, that's another area where sometimes it's not even such a moral thing, it's just a disagreement. Are there biblical examples of that where people had to come to some kind of settlement but was maybe dissatisfying for each other?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I guess the answer is yes and no. It depends, again, on the nature of the disagreement, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So if it's a disagreement over something that's black and white in Scripture, mm-hmm. If it's a disagreement over a moral issue, or if it's a disagreement over a theological issue, both of those are treated very abruptly in mm-hmm. Scripture. You know, you are to put out, in fact, false teachers. You know, that there's no room for that. There's no ambiguity about that. There's no, oh, just bear with it. So I think things of that nature, you're right, that they're very straightforward. But there's a whole other area. I just think of Paul and Barnabas and, you know, Apollos and John Mark and sort of all falling out in Acts. Ray Evans, one of our colleagues, says to us sometimes, he wonders if that's one of the reasons that the Spirit inspired that story to be included in the book of Acts, was just to show us that it does happen. Mm. And it's sometimes you just have to say it's happened, there's nothing we can do about it. I think there's evidence in Scripture they were later reconciled. But there was a sharp disagreement. They went separate ways. And Acts just seems to record that. It doesn't seem to apportion blame or a particular moral verdict. It just seems to say there was a sharp disagreement, mm-hmm. and that's what happened. Certainly the way I read it doesn't seem to be any apportionment of blame. It just, that's the fallen world we live in, that sometimes people do fall out.
Yeah, and it's a helpful story from that point of view, I think, because it's just an illustration of the complexity of life and some of the dilemmas of life and the fact that not everything is reconciled, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
A fairy story Bible, they would have made up and they'd have sorted it out, or Paul would have been right or Barnabas would have been right, but actually we're left with a slight ambiguity. Hey, that's real life, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right to point out that there are some things that are criminal and there's no ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And there have been two very sad stories in the news just this last week, haven't there? Two court cases that have not just come to light, but they've come to a conclusion. One is the 9 o'clock service, which in the 90s was very infamous. It's now become, I guess, service with young people that was happening in Sheffield, was a plant from a church in Sheffield. Chris Brain, who led that, has just been found guilty of sexual assault and various other crimes this week. And really a very grubby story. I read the news report this morning and didn't enjoy one little bit of it, and was just slightly taken back really with the way that people were hoodwinked into it, reading back seems to be bizarre. You know, the people, they had a service at Greenbelt and they had women dancing in their underwear. And, you know, you just think at every level, people should have spotted that this was not right. But anyway, it's come to a conclusion, which is good. And then up by you, in Glasgow, another case in the Free Church of Scotland continuing, which was a split from the Free Church of Scotland in 2000. A pastor, was he actually in Glasgow? Was he a pastor in Glasgow, James Hiram, or
Dumbarton, I think. So just Dumbarton, outside Glasgow, okay. But in that okay. area. Yeah.
Convicted this week of rape and beatings. Mm. There's a statement on the Free Church of Scotland continuing website that you can read about their response to that. Really very, they're grubby stories. They're messy. They're two people who are in positions of authority. And we grieve over these stories, don't we? We grieve for the victims and the people who've been treated badly. We grieve that voices went unheard. They're just tragic stories. And there's no ambiguity about these, is there? There's no leave it with the Lord in these cases.
No, not at all. I mean, they are shocking when you read the details. They're heartbreaking. And as you say, the first response is... just the sorrow for the victims,
that
people were in these situations, were so mistreated, became the victims of really despicable behaviour, and all the more kind of despicable because it was cloaked with a veneer of, you know, religiosity, you know, the gospel being used as a kind of vehicle to facilitate some of these forms of abuse. And then, of course, you grieve because you know of the damage these stories do to the gospel. It's another reason for people to kind of reject the gospel, to think that the church is just full of hypocrites and is no better than anybody else. And in one sense, of course, that's true. But of course, in another sense, it's true of humanity in general. I was thinking the fact is that these stories are just revealing of the human heart. They happen everywhere. They happen in politics, where people use politics as a cover for despicable behaviour. It happened in the media and the arts. We saw a few years ago some of the big charities being called out because of some senior people who were misusing their positions, doing humanitarian work, you know, famine relief and nation building, but were using that as a kind of cover for other immoral activities. And it's just a reminder that even the best things in humanity, even the something as good as the gospel, as good as the church, it can be twisted and misused.
Is it not more, I'm not sure I fully agree with you, Andy, is it not more heinous than that, in that using the gospel as a cover for that sort of sin feels like the worst kind of the worst kind of sinfulness? Because I think it does damage the cause of Christ. It's not just that the individuals have been damaged, and that's reprehensible, and you're right, that is a cause for great sorrow and lament. But I think it seems to me that we've got to say a little bit more than just it's just the human heart. It's using the gospel as a cover seems to me to be the most sort of reprehensible sin in some ways. And, you know, just that makes it even worse in my mind.
I don't disagree with you at all on that regard, because you've taken something which is so precious and so sacred.
Yeah. And you've made something holy, profane. Yeah.
That thing. So that in itself, you know, as another layer, you know, of kind of offence to it. I guess what I'm thinking of there is the response to somebody who will say, well, the fact that this is happening in the church makes the claims of the church
I'm with you.
A lie or less credible. And I think the response I was trying to say there is want to say, well, actually, this is a revelation of the human heart rather than a unique weakness in the church. Obviously, there can be vulnerabilities in any organization. The church has got its own in terms of, you know, we want to be generous. We want to be accommodating. We want to be trusting. And there are dangers for us in that. That's why we need good safeguarding procedures. And we need a little bit of boldness and courage, I think, as well. Because in all these situations, there are probably people who saw things that they thought were a little bit odd, a little bit questionable, but maybe didn't feel it was appropriate to kind of, you know, say something. And in hindsight, they probably wish they had. And we just need to have that little bit of courage at times to say to somebody, hang on a minute, brother, you know, can I just ask you about this situation? Or I was a bit uncomfortable about what happened there, to put their finger on it. Otherwise, yeah. I think we can be slightly over-trusting and over-pious to the extent that actually we open the door for something.
I think in the Sheffield case, people did say something and were ignored. And that's the other sort of point, isn't it? That I think the safeguarding procedures that we have in churches now are really critical. They're not just a box-ticking exercise. We, you, as we do, we have to renew our safeguarding policy every year, and it seems to come round very quickly every year. And it feels like we're always renewing it. And I think at that point, we've got to remind ourselves, this is a good thing to be doing. It's a noble thing. It's good to have a proper safeguarding policy. It's good to be reviewing it. That's actually part of godly living in church life. It shouldn't. It's not a box-ticking exercise, is it?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's like your fire safety checks. It's like renewing your house insurance. These are really important things, because if they go wrong, they can be catastrophic.
Yeah.
So you have to have them a real priority. I mean, yourself,
I think
just,
for
yourself, Adrian, just in terms of that response to somebody. So you're talking to somebody in a cafe or on a bus or whatever, and they're looking at this story and they say, just shows you the church are a bunch of charlatans. You can't believe anything that they say. What's your kind of response to that, you know, pastorally or evangelistically?
I mean, Jesus said, by their fruit you will know them. It seems to me that these people are not Christians. I mean, we can never see into someone's heart, can we? But I think I want to say to someone, if that's the way they're behaving, they're using the church as a cover for evil. That's not a Christian behaviour. I had a similar situation closer to home, something that happened in my own situation. And I think I came to the conclusion that the person, if they're acting that way, is they've proved themselves not to be a Christian. Now, I always want to be a little bit careful about commenting on whether people are saved or not. But I think I want to, these people have been found guilty, James Haram and Chris Brain. I want to disown myself from them. They don't feel like brothers in Christ. So I think if I'm speaking to a non-Christian, I think I want to say, well, you can never be sure, but as far as I can tell, this person is not a Christian, because Jesus said, by their fruits you'll know them. And I think it seems to me that's a simple answer. Perhaps it's simplistic. Perhaps I am being too simplistic. I don't know. But I think I want to disown them. I don't want to excuse them. And I think a deep theological argument about the depths of sin, that is appropriate at some point, talking to an unbeliever. But actually, I want to say this is not the way that Christians behave. It's evil. The other interesting thing for me in Sheffield, well, let's put this story to bed, because we need to talk about some other things, is just, how did he get away with it? It's because people thought they saw results. And I think there is a lesson there for us, isn't there, that people came. So some very famous people were drawn in. Anita Roddick, famously, who formed the Body Shop, gave lots of money. George Carey thought it was a project that needed to be replicated in every city, because they saw people coming in. They saw results and almost therefore turned a blind eye to things that they should have seen that were wrong and suspicious. And I think we love results. We love numbers. The book of Acts is full of numbers. We want to talk about people being converted. We love results, but we're not driven by results at any cost, are we?
Yeah. No, and a good question to ask is, if this wasn't kind of leader A or sort of ministry leader B with all their kind of success and the kind of associated kind of glow that goes with that, would we still bite our lip? If this was a younger, unknown person, would we pull them up for this? Would we ask a question? Would we question it? And if we would, then we probably should, when it comes to the older, more senior leader, however kind of successful or how much status they have.
Andy, what else have you seen in the news this week?
Yeah, so I thought it'd be good to talk about just at a completely different level, the Swedish church building that
New. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I saw one of the captions on the news describing it as a holy roller, which I thought was quite good.
In Kiruna, isn't it? In Sweden. I always think of Sweden as sort of, pretty little villages and Stockholm and all the rest of it. But of course, there's a large mining communities, especially in the north. And This is a wooden church that once had the accolade. I'm not quite sure whether this is a very narrow niche market of being the most popular church building over 100 years old in Sweden. I mean, that's quite a niche category, isn't it?
Yes,
made of wood and suffering because the ground underneath was going away because of the iron ore mining. So they've moved it 5 kilometres. It's quite... Did you see any of the footage of it being moved?
I did, yeah. I mean, an amazing engineering task, isn't it? I mean, it's quite phenomenal to do that. And it's nice to see those kind of things, you know, just at a kind of cultural level, you know, the care, you know, the sense of... You know, actually, it's very impressive, and you know, it's good to see that kind of just concern, you know, to preserve things. Yeah. But I guess, you know, to take it into the nitty gritty of a kind of podcast conversation, I guess there are questions there about the about buildings, church buildings, about the pros and cons of them. About wanting
I had a look on the website, and as far as I can see, they have one service in it a month.
Yeah.
And I saw a picture on the BBC News website of hundreds of people coming to watch it being moved. And it just seemed to me there was a deep irony that hundreds of people turned out to see the church being moved. And in fact, normally those hundreds of people are not present on a Sunday for a service worshipping the living God. So there's something about a love for a building, which is true in our communities, isn't it? I think when I was in East London, East London Tabernacle had this sort of 1950s cathedral. People loved it. People were very fond of it locally. Didn't come to it. And we've got to find a balance, haven't we? Buildings are useful, helpful. They're really important. We want to invest in them. We want to make them as useful as possible and smart as possible, welcoming as possible. And yet we know the church is not the building. We say that a lot. We've got to hold these two things in tension. Yeah, just tell us a story very briefly of your building, because your building that your church meets in once belonged to someone else, didn't it?
Yeah, well, basically, so the church I go to in Glasgow is from a kind of Brethren background. We've got a fairly traditional kind of stone building, but the building itself was the side hall of a much larger Church of Scotland building.
Okay.
So Church of Scotland buildings, I guess like many church architecture kind of buildings, had three halls. You had your main kind of sanctuary, auditorium. There was a kind of games hall type sized hall next to it. And then there was a small kind of meeting hall. So we got the games hall size. This is back in the 1920s, I think, the church would have moved there. And then it had an extension built on since. So we don't have quite the grandeur of the original building, which was demolished since. But you're in a church, Adrian, where you don't have a building.
No, I mean, we worked out the other day, we're I think 15 years old as a church. We're in our 11th location. So we've had a fairly nomadic life. We're now in a school, which we love. It works very well for us. But it is still a building. It's not that we're building less.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's important, isn't it? We don't own a building, but we do still have a building that we use. And we think about how to use it. We think about how to make it safe. So we were talking about earlier. We think about how to make it welcoming within the limitations we've got. We think about how to use it at other times. So actually, we are talking about buildings all the time, even though we don't own a building.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's a little bit too simplistic for Christians to say, well, we know the church is not the building, so we don't care about buildings. No, we do care about where we meet. We do care about visibility and access and toilets and how well people can hear. And you know, buildings really matter, don't they?
Yeah. No, and you want to get that balance, don't you, between being respectful to an older building and to its kind of history and the sort of legacy of it, but also making it fit for purpose. So you don't want your building just to become a museum. And I guess there's an element of that with the Swedish church. You know, it's being preserved as a bit of a museum piece. And sometimes people get very kind of highly strung about buildings and won't make changes in them because, you know, classically, you know, Spurgeon preached in that pulpit, and no matter how dysfunctional it is now or how much space it's taking up or how much it's falling apart, you know, it's almost like it's a sacred object. And actually, just in from an evangelistic point of view, you know, if you go to a doctor's surgery now, it will be modern, you know, it will have kind of maybe sofas, it might have a TV in the corner, you know.
Don't write in, by the way, if your doctor's surgery is not like that. Well, maybe it's just the NHS in Scotland.
Well, we're maybe old enough, certainly I am, to remember the the days you went to doctor's surgery and you sat basically in the doctor's living room.
That's right.
On basically dining, old dining chairs that had been obviously borrowed and assembled. So there's a kind of expectation. We don't have to be worldly about that, but there's a kind of an expectation of a certain kind of level of kind of standard and provision and decor, you know. And I think churches are wise to be mindful of that. Because you certainly don't want to be bringing, you know, visitors into a place that just feels like a bit of an antiquated death trap at times. So, yeah. And those are resource questions as well. You know, I'm not being simplistic. You know, obviously they cost money. But it's not allowing your church just to become fossilized as a museum piece, but actually remembering that this is a living, you know, kind of contemporary kind of gathering of people, you know, for the gospel today. And I think some of the best church kind of refurbishments have managed to get the balance of both. I think of like Charlotte Chapel in Edinburgh, a big traditional kind of church building, but really sympathetically refurbished so that you've got a kind of modern feel, but it's kept a lot of the kind of traditional features. And getting that balance is helpful.
Yeah.
But the question I was going to ask you just in terms of Christchurch, because obviously you meet in a school. What are the pros and cons? Because there was a kind of body of people in the past who very much, oh, we should sell our buildings and just meet in community halls and libraries. Well, but what's the kind of the
pros are, especially for a newish church, there's no big upfront investment. We haven't had to spend £3 million on a building. We couldn't afford that. And anything that goes wrong with a building, we're not liable for. So, you know, if the toilet stops working or if it needs repainting, or, you know, that someone else is paying for that, and that's good. We get a fairly reasonable rate. And I think it's an easy place to invite people. It's kind of visible in the community. It's got good facilities. And so all of those things are upsides. That the downsides, I think, are obvious too. We can't use it midweek, particularly. We haven't really got a visible base. We have to work hard at making it visible on a Sunday with banners and things like that. And it just feels a little bit fragile, I suppose. You know, we've had to move location. Other churches will be in similar positions. You're not going to get thrown out of your building tomorrow. We could. And so there's a fragility to it, which I don't mind. I think that's healthy for us, actually, as a church. But yeah, I mean, I think the pros and cons are, I certainly, if someone offered me an empty building tomorrow, I would take it. But I, within limits, obviously. But yeah, I think the important thing, we're out of time, Andy, but the important thing to say is if there's ever a vote in Glasgow in that sort of niche category for Britain's favourite ex-Church of Scotland building that is now being used as an FIEC building, I don't know how many contenders there would be in that category, but I'm voting for Greenview.
Okay.
So I think, you know, how many other options would there be? I don't know, but Greenview would win that award, I think.
Yeah, there's one or two others. I think Harper, you know, it's got a very classic kind of feel to it. And again, another example of a very good refurbishment there.
Okay, there you go.
Worlds, but yeah. Do you want to say anything very quickly, Adrian, on exam results just coming out?
Well, very, very quickly, because we're almost out of time. It's that time of exam results, isn't it? And actually, I think that's a key moment for church leaders. You know, we're leading parents in our churches, and we want to strike a balance, don't we, between making education and exam results an idol. Very easy to fall into that camp. But equally, I think there's a mistake we might make the other way, saying that they just don't matter at all. You know, you can be successful if you fail your exams, don't worry. I mean, Jeremy Clarkson was a meme this week going out saying, you know, I failed all my A-levels, look at me now, look how rich I am. And I think we do want to pursue excellence in life. We want our kids to do that as far as they're able, but we don't want to make education an idol. And as with so much of life, we want to steer a middle course and help parents do that. I just wonder if this is a key moment for that with exam results.
I think so. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think it's like bodily exercise, isn't it? You know, it's got some benefit, you know? So I think the danger is that it becomes, you've got the Jeremy Clarksons and it's kind of meaningless, you know, don't worry.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you've got the other side where it becomes like, it means everything, you know?
Yeah.
You know, your whole life is kind of hanging on this bit of paper. And of course, it's in the middle, you know, in that it has benefits. You know, it will help you. You need it to do certain things in life, to have qualifications. But at the same time, it's not all or nothing and it shouldn't define you. And I think for Christian parents as well, it's just to watch that we don't make an idol out of it. Ultimately, education is not going to save your children. Your children can be brilliant. That's they can have PhDs and qualifications come out of their ears and end up far from the Lord. Education itself isn't the most important thing, but it is an important thing. So just my final question for you, Adrian, is how do we as Christians kind of celebrate in godly ways? How do we avoid, you know, becoming kind of boastful and showing off? Equally, we don't want to be kind of austere and kind of, you know, we can't ever kind of celebrate things or praise.
Well, Joel, our producer, is I can feel him scowling at me because we've run out of time. I think the answer is, we do believe that God grants us success. You know, when things go well, that you know, every good gift comes from above. So I think we want to help people celebrate success well. We don't want to be embarrassed about that. But we do also want to put things in their place. I think that's the key thing. We want to help people put their things in their place. So I think, for example, as we pray for our children in church, if our prayers for the kids in church are always about help them to do well in exams, you know, as an exam season, help them to do really well, I think we're setting the wrong tone. So we do want to pray for them to, you know, to do their best and to and not be anxious and to excel in what they can do. But we also want to be praying for their spiritual life. So I think so much of this is in the tone that we set in church, tone that we set from front, the tone that we set in our prayers, the content of our prayers. I think all these things matter. And I think that's the way I think we really lead the church, which is one of the reasons I wonder if that the kind of the modern way is to let the church service be run by lots of different people. You know, the music group might do the music, someone might come and do the prayers, someone else might come and do the reading. But I think you can make a case, and we'll end with this. I think you can make a case, just to be provocative, for one of the leaders, the elders, the pastor, doing a lot of that. They can still split it up amongst themselves. But actually, in that corporate act of worship, that's how you lead people in some of these areas. Mm. And I wonder if we've lost something by jettisoning that. Anyway, there we are. That's a provocative thought to leave you with, Andy. Thanks so much for joining us. This has been In the News. If you've enjoyed, please do rate and review, and we'll catch up with you soon. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.